What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Welcome to the Katie Halper Show. You can hear the Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. Please make sure that you rate and review us on iTunes and subscribe to us on SoundCloud. And to hear the full interview, the extended interview, make sure you go to our Patreon, patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehalpershow. We're really excited to be talking to two special guests, actually. Shuja Hader is a writer and musician whose writing appears in places like Jacobin and the New York Times, and he is a contributing editor at Viewpoint magazine. Nick Murray is a former editor at The Village Voice and Rolling Stone, and he just came back from Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks for talking to us. So we're going to talk to you, Shuja, about a piece that you just wrote that's getting actually a lot of attention. You wrote it at Jacobin, and it's called One Has to Take Sides. And the subtitle of it, the subheader, is Many Sides Aren't Promoting Racism and Hatred. One side is, and ours is committed to stopping them. So actually, let's start with you, Shuja.
Yeah, so the title of the essay comes from a novel by Graham Greene called The Quiet American. It's about a guy in Vietnam who is a journalist who is kind of dedicated to remaining objective and not getting involved. And it kind of displays how that kind of falls apart. It leads to situations of compromised morality. And it's something that I was thinking about when Trump made his statement after the events in Charlottesville, when he said something about how we saw hatred and bigotry and violence on many sides.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
Which, you know, to any reasonable observer is completely ridiculous when you have Nazis on one side. You know, you can't describe an equivalence or a level playing field when it's Nazis and anyone.
And non-Nazis.
Yeah, whatever is opposed to Nazis, you know, it's not going to be on the same level. But for Trump, it was.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides.
And then for a second, it wasn't.
Racism is evil. And those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists.
And then it was again.
Excuse me. What about the alt-left that came charging at the, as you say, the alt-right? Do they have any semblance of guilt?
When he actually said that the Nazis were bad, but the alt-left was just as bad, which was a phrase he picked up from a bunch of liberal pundits, which was an unexpected but kind of fitting new grouping.
Right. Callback.
Between the two of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, that term, the alt-left, comes from James Walcott, who wrote about this in Vanity Fair. He's actually a very, very good writer. And
that's what they tell me.
Yeah. I mean, he's a smart guy. He's a good writer. But
I don't know.
Yeah. Keep going.
Did you see what he wrote about Louise Mensch?
No.
It was a little further back when this whole Russia conspiracy thing was really kind of spiraling out into complete speculative conjecture. He was one of the people who took Louise Mensch the most seriously in like the mainstream media. And I think the phrase he used to refer to her in one of his columns was James Bond on jet skis.
Wow.
Was the way he described her. Yeah, something like that. He took her really seriously as someone who had valid information about some kind of espionage conspiracy, which now we know that she was literally just making up just out of her ass.
In the late 70s, Walcott wrote some good pieces about punk music.
Right, okay.
So I don't know what's been going on since then.
Yeah, he's been off for...
Yeah, there's a whole gap there. I don't know that we can't account for.
Yeah, he's had a couple rough decades.
The 80s.
Yeah, the
80s, we don't know what happened.
Let's talk about the term the alt-left.
The idea behind that was the claim that people on the left and people on the right end up meeting in the middle or outside of the middle. I don't know, somewhere on the other end of a geometric structure.
A horseshoe, perhaps?
Yeah, that's the usual way people talk about it. But the idea is that some kind of focus on economic issues leads people to turn into racist, sexist bigots in the same way as the people on the alt-right are. Which, you know, needless to say, doesn't really make sense because... you're talking about people advocating for universal rights, for kind of egalitarian society, which is based on a totally different ideological framework than the people on the alt-right who are openly interested in like the kind of bogus science of racial difference and racial hierarchy. But for people in the center, the idea of some kind of universal political ideology, it's too scary. It sounds like socialism, which is disturbing to them, but ultimately that's what it is, and that's what you have to be if you're going to advocate for an actual opposition to inequality and injustice. So that's why there had to be a new kind of slander that was invented, and which I don't know if it's actually Walcott was the first person to use it. But he was certainly the first person to kind of systematize it and put it out into, an extended form. And it really got picked up all over the place by people who wanted to carry on the divisions that got generated by the 2016 primary between people who didn't want to consider ideas of economic justice and wanted to kind of preserve, you know, this neoliberal hierarchy in society without the appearance of inequality.
And can you tell us what inspired you to write this piece?
Well, you know, I mean, I was kind of monitoring the events of the day from a distance online, just seeing the reports as they came in, which were really confusing, which were really uncertain. It was very hard to know who was there, who was being affected. But it was really, it really got to me, actually, to find out about the people who had put their lives on the line and at least one person we know who lost her life in this confrontation, which was not, it wasn't for her. You know, she was there for others. She was there for the most vulnerable in her community. And so it's really, you know, the most tragic thing that you can see happen, someone's life to be taken in an act of selflessness, which is what really made it, all the more you know, distasteful, even disgraceful, that the way that this was kind of politically depicted in mainstream political rhetoric was to ascribe an equivalence between the sides that we saw there. You know, there was an article in The Atlantic just shortly before the events in Charlottesville happened, called I believe it was called The Rise of the Violent Left. And it said that there was a kinship, I think was the word that was used, between fascists and anti-fascists, people who were there to protect themselves and others from neo-Nazis and white supremacists and the KKK and so on. There's a, you know, you really have to do some mental contortions to believe that fascists and the opposite of fascists, anti-fascists, have a similar moral character. You know, if you believe that a group that kind of dehumanizes a segment of humanity and the side that wants to prevent them from doing violence to those people, if you think that those two are somehow the same, I don't know how you can arrive at that conclusion and, you know, consider yourself on the left, certainly, or even to be a person of good moral or logical character. And, you know, Trump is someone who blatantly defies that. He said, you know, that the alt-left is just as equally to blame for the violence as the right. But we've seen people in the center and in the kind of more influential, powerful segments of liberalism saying the same thing. And that really is dismaying in terms of what side they've decided to take. Either they've decided to step out when it's very clear that one side is dangerous, or they've kind of tacitly accepted the side that opposes justice and equality and liberty.
Because even by their own standards of what they're committed to, right? Like, I thought that something that united the left and liberals was a contempt for Nazis.
Apparently not. I mean, the contempt is equally distributed beyond Nazis to as Trump put it, the many sides that were involved. And, you know, the other organizations that were there, I mean, you know, it was the rally was called Unite the Right, and it was. Yeah, so the rally was called Unite the Right, and the idea was to put together all these different reactionary groups, which, you know, the distinction may be less meaningful to us, but it was the point was to demonstrate that they're a unified mass. And a kind of similar thing happened in response on the left. There's groups, and, you know, if you're on the left, you know that, like, left sectarianism can be as vicious and as hostile as any, you know, kind of genuine political division, whereas it's actually usually very small. But, you know, all kinds of different left parties, socialist parties, communist parties, anarchist groups, even people who weren't members of groups, people who were in groups that were dedicated to more particular goals. You know, there were local chapters of Black Lives Matter there, of immigrant advocacy groups there. So you had all these different groups coming together to say that they opposed racism and Nazism and white supremacy. But the segment of the political spectrum that doesn't want to sign on is in the center, and it's the people, you know, at the Atlantic or at the Center for American Progress. Or, you know, all of these kind of influential political bodies that are saying, well, we're going to sit this one out and you're all equally distasteful to us.
Let's bring you in, Nick. So we're going to talk to Nick Murray, a former editor at The Village Voice and Rolling Stone, and he is just coming to us. He just came back from Charlottesville, Virginia. Can you kind of fill out some of the... the atmosphere in that you experienced in Charlottesville, and also what this kind of academic or intellectual seeming debate actually has to do with very real things. Let's read. I'm going to read some of the things that Trump and that various centrists have said, and I want you to respond and tell me how accurate they are based on what you saw.
All right.
Okay. How about you want to do a true false, and then you can elaborate on them?
Yeah, that will work.
All right. I wish we had a buzzer, but
will
okay.
it be all false? I think.
Well, don't let's not. No, let's
yeah,
not.
Be
don't be. Don't. Yeah, exactly.
All right. Don't tell him who said it.
Don't make an ass out of you and me.
There were some very fine Nazis. Trump was totally right about that.
He was right. Yeah. I don't look. We on the left, we don't make assumptions. We judge people based on the content of their character, not on the swastikas that they may be holding, not on the color of their flags. So,
my friend heard one of the white nationalist marchers yell in a confrontation, "How can I be a fascist? I'm Spanish." I don't know if he was very fine, but there's certainly some adjective.
Right.
That applies to that logic.
Cultured. Fino, if you will.
Nick, did you have any conversations personally with any of the fascists?
No, there was one that either before or after a physical confrontation, not with me, but with people near me, turned to me and said, "Is there anything wrong with loving your own kind?" And I yelled at him a little, and then I stepped back and realized I was wasting breath. That's the only time I actually addressed anything.
Okay, so this is the hot take. White nationalism, self-love.
Self-care, self-love.
Radical
self-care.
People,
I heard one of them talking about self-determination. They just want self-determination.
Yeah.
Well, they've been doing this for a long time, right? They look at what the left is saying and they try to pick up on it,
right,
so that they can come up with a way of talking that they think we can't object to, which is why Richard Spencer says that he wants a safe space for white people and whatever, you know, bullshit.
Right.
But, you know, that's what they've been doing for, you know, decades now.
So can you, Nick, can you tell us about what kind of organizing you saw there? And like, Cheryl Gay Stolberg said that it looked like the left was as hateful as the right. Neera Tanden said that, you know, they're the alt-left who want to join with the fascists. There are plenty of ways to find them. So how many people on the alt-left did you see trying to join with the fascists while you were at this protest?
You know, I myself considered it after being confronted by the Love Your Own Kind man.
Pretty persuasive.
Yeah, he that's why I had to pull back.
Right.
Obviously none. I mean, that's a ridiculous claim. And as for being filled with hate, I certainly hate Nazis. I'm not going to say there was
that's
no
really
hate,
problematic.
But, well, like, I think a telling thing is there's this video with the fascist or white nationalist organizer Baked Alaska, where he's pepper sprayed, and you can hear someone say, "We've got a VIP," and they clear the other people receiving care out of the way so Baked Alaska can get care.
Mm.
And there's definitely nothing like that going on the left. And although I think everyone there hated fascism, the love between people it was necessary, because if we weren't loving each other, expressing some sort of positive feeling to each other, it would have been just a really unbearably miserable day. But especially everyone was supporting everyone, and especially there was so much clergy involved, so many faith leaders, and they one priest just like hugged me, which was really nice. I don't want to say he was filled with hate or had as much hate in his heart as the alt-right. I think that's ridiculous.
Okay, so hot take. Hugging priests, not as hateful as a Nazi.
Yeah, I mean,
that's really controversial.
I know.
But, you know, the thing is that this concept that we have of hate is more vague than people often allow for. I mean, there's a categorical difference, I think, between hating a group of people and hating fascism, like Nick was saying, that was a kind of underlying motive for the counter-protesters. I hate injustice. I hate fascism. I hate bigotry. That's an ideal that I hold on to and that I feel with some conviction and that I'm never going to let go of, you know? And that's the other side of the love you have for your comrades and for your neighbors is to hate the forces that would harm them.
Right.
And that's what's always motivated people fighting for justice. You know, you don't fight with unless there's conflict. And if she saw hate among the counter protesters, then you know maybe it was there, but it's not on the same moral plane.
The only behavior that I can remember seeing where I thought that's kind of despicable. It wasn't hatred that fueled it, but it was the sort of callousness. And it was after this car drove through, and medics were right there, and I think it was the anarchist groups had been prepared for this, and it may have been the dying girl, and if it wasn't her, it was injured people, and her comrades took banners and covered her up so she could be,
wow,
these people could
Jesus.
Be in privacy while they received care, and a Reuters cameraman and one or two other news cameramen were trying to get their cameras over the banner to get shots of these people that had just been hit by a car.
Right.
That's the only time where I thought this is like truly despicable behavior. And it wasn't coming from anyone on the left or any.
Right. So those were the you're saying that, yes, that you witnessed
besides
some despicable
fascists.
Behavior from non-Nazis, but it was
from the media, not
right.
from.
Well, that's the behavior that's motivated by the idea of objectivity. That's the
yeah, exactly.
the kind of the false position that goes back to the reference in the title and the piece that I wrote, referencing The Quiet American, that if you're trying to stay out of every situation, that has an effect too. You know, your complacency has sometimes a very destructive effect. And the line from the book that a Vietnamese communist tells the protagonist of The Quiet American, that sooner or later you have to take a side if you want to remain human.
Mm.
You know, it's not possible for us to be transcendent and omniscient. You know, these circumstances that we deal with require us to take action.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's like that Howard Zinn quote, right? You can't be neutral on a moving train.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Let's see. So have you gotten any pushback on this, by the way, Shuja?
On that article?
Yeah.
Well, you know, the thing that happened after this was that, you know, a lot of people noticed that, you know, there's been universal fascination and despair over Heather Heyer's death. And, you know, a lot of other people were injured, but I believe that Heather Heyer is the only documented death at this point. And even Trump was forced to acknowledge it. A friend of hers, incidentally, said, you know, Heather wouldn't want her name coming out of Trump's lips. She detested him. But, you know, all of her friends and family said that she was a person who had a social conscience of great depth, that she was very motivated by her awareness of injustice and her dedication to fighting it. And among the ways that we know this was manifested was that she happened to be a Bernie Sanders supporter. She happened to be a Bernie bro of the type that has been, you know, maligned as equivalent to the alt-right.
Right.
You know, when you look at that, that kind of a slanderous characterization of a political stance, and you apply it to someone like her who was behaved with such courage and whose life ended in such profound tragedy, that's just disgraceful.
Right.
You know, that's really appalling. And at this point, people who are using the slur alt-left or Bernie bro, I think they should recognize that they're talking about people like Heather Heyer. They're talking about people who have shown a commitment to fighting injustice and who have actually done so at great personal risk and sometimes a great personal loss. And if you're going to describe them as being equivalent to Nazis, you got to go look in the mirror and really spend some time figuring yourself out, because you're not helping.
Yeah, I think I'm actually very shocked that people haven't just shut up. Like, it's shocking to me that people are doubling down on this narrative of alt-left and Bernie bro.
Yeah.
Given that.
Well, yeah. You know what?
Yeah.
What Heather Heyer's friends and family said was, you know, Heather would want us to carry on her struggle. She would want us to keep fighting against injustice and protecting each other and caring for each other. I think that what Heather's best friend, who actually witnessed her murder, said was that after her death, she thought, what would Heather do? And Heather would go harder now. She would continue her struggle. She would continue defending her neighbors and her comrades, and she would continue trying to make a better world. What she wouldn't do is hang up her hat and say, don't politicize tragedy and, you know, just go home and keep your mouth shut. She would want us to stay out there standing for the ideals that she stood for, that she gave her life for.
Yeah, what do you guys think about the idea of politicizing someone's death? I mean, I think it's not politicizing. You can exploit someone's death, and then you can actually contextualize it and honor it. I mean, are we not honoring the memory of someone and their struggle and their life when we actually acknowledge what they were about, as opposed to pretending that they're something that they're not?
I mean, she was killed by a fascist while she was protesting against fascism. There's nothing that's not political about the way she died. Mm. It's not that politics are coming in after and trying to claim it. She died in the most political way that one can die.
You know, plus these types of things are politicized all the time. You know, are you going to tell me that the people who died on 9/11, that their deaths weren't politicized?
Right. Yeah, to just justify a war, I mean, barely politicized.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it seems like basically we're saying that, like, you can't, try to deduce a political ideal from someone's death, but you can start a war if you want.
Right.
Like, that's actually okay, but anything else is, you know, kind of unseemly.
Right.
It's a really bizarre way of determining what's proper. I don't think... it's ethical or reasonable to ascribe to that. You know, we need to base that on what happened and on who was involved. And in this case, it's very clear what happened, which was that political forces were involved in unjustly taking someone's life, and that she was fighting against them. And we dishonor her if we give up the struggle.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's her biography, right? It's not distorting something.
Yeah. We do know a bit about what her political positions were through her online presence and through interviews with her friends and family.
By the way, I feel like I can't say this, but I totally can. Like, she supported Sanders. She put stuff on her Facebook page about Bernie Sanders. And I don't say that because I want to like dig at people who supported Clinton, but I say it because I can't believe that people are still using the term Bernie bro, given that the woman who was killed, literally killed, like run over by a car, that it really is desecrate. I mean, it's disgusting. It's totally desecrating her memory. It's like, I really think it's inhuman and inhumane. Like if I were these people who peddled the Bernie bro narrative, I would just be like, I'm never going to say that word again. Or I apologize.
Yeah. They should be hanging their heads in shame at this point.
Yeah.
Especially after Trump has started using their language.
I mean, So the latest thing is, the latest news is that Trump actually pushed back on people criticizing him for not condemning the violence or for doing the both sides thing by saying, well, what about the alt-left, right? And I just want to put this in context. Like, anytime someone, you know, the guy who killed someone in Oregon, he had, like, a Bernie thing on his – this is actually interesting because I'm just realizing, like, anytime someone bad does something and they have – a remote affiliation with Sanders, they're a Bernie bro, right? Or they represent what Sanders really thinks. Everything from the shooting in Virginia to the random guy who was probably psychotic in Oregon.
Well, wasn't one of the guys he stabbed also like a big Bernie supporter?
Yeah.
And that guy died defending Muslim people on that train that the attacker was trying to kill.
Exactly.
So I don't know. Trying to extract conclusions from that is kind of a bogus operation. I think.
I mean, I just keep thinking it's just so sinister and dishonest. And it's like if the Bernie Sanders affiliation is relevant when someone does something horrible, then it's pretty relevant when someone is killed, right? Like, shouldn't these people be talking about this nonstop?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, why isn't this?
I think so.
I mean, they can, because then they'd have to say, oh, look, a Bernie Sanders supporter is like a martyr and hero. So it's not obviously in their best interest. Can you talk about what kind of political affiliation you saw at the rally in terms of how people identified, flags, all that stuff?
I think if the primary was held among people who were on the streets in Charlottesville, I would say Bernie might have won. People who don't vote might have came in second, and Hillary might have been third. Well, this is one thing that was sort of shocking to me when I got back online, because of what I was doing in Charlottesville, I was kind of communicating information between an off-site headquarters and people working on the ground. So that meant I was able to get updates without checking Twitter or looking at Facebook. So I didn't log on to Facebook until 6 or 7 at night, and it was so shocking to see people saying, like liberals criticizing Antifa on Twitter, because on the streets there was nothing like that, and it was, everyone had each other's back, and I think that is, whatever success that we had in Charlottesville wouldn't have been possible without everyone having each other's back. And people talked about diversity of tactics and in the meetings leading up to it. And it was totally, totally respected by everyone. People who were, you know, involved in physical confrontations, like, understood that not everybody could take part in that. And people, medics, and people at other areas seemed pretty grateful for people who were willing to put their bodies on the line. Like, you saw Cornel West and at least one other of the clergy that was there afterwards that literally said Antifa saved our lives, you know?
Huh, interesting.
So it was really everyone working together. And by everyone, so that's like, I think a lot of unaffiliated people who just came out to fight, to say that they didn't want this in their community, anarchist groups, the DSA showed up. It was kind of cute. The DSA, most of the confrontations happened in the early morning, and then the DSA showed up at their exact scheduled time at noon for the march, and were like very punctual and didn't realize that a lot had already taken place. But they were there for sure. other socialist organizations.
Black Lives Matter.
The Bob,
right.
Black Lives Matter, they were involved. Black Lives Matter Charlottesville is a, I think it's, I don't know the size, but I think it's small. But regardless of their size, they do really awesome work. And they had been organizing for a long time on this. The Bobovakian people were...
What's that, Refuse and Resist, or RCP?
Yeah, they were out there. It was like, it was really, it seemed like everyone.
Right, every, yeah.
And as I said, a lot of faith leaders. I saw, there was this like 20-year-old kid in a Gary Johnson t-shirt. I
don't say that.
I have a lot of respect
don't
for that
it.
Kid.
Don't near us, yeah, I'm just kidding.
I think
this is a really important point, though. Like, you, and I think this is a very honest position. Like, someone can really reject Antifa without equating them with the Nazis. I mean, this is what drives me a little bit crazy. Like, Antifa, which is anti-fascism, right? And it often will involve confrontations. Like, we should not be pretending that that being a tactic or a strategy or even an ideology that you disagree with makes them the equivalent of Nazis. Like, throwing a rock right. through a window, as reprehensible as you may think it is, or as divisive as you may think it is, or even as like self-defeating, even as sabotaging as it is of the left as you may think it is not beating someone because they are black or Jewish or gay. And like, that's what people did, right? I mean, there was unprovoked violence on the part committed by these white nationalists, neo-Nazis, whatever you want to call them. I mean, again, this is just an inherent part of the ideology. And what you're really saying, if you're accepting the equivalence, is you're also smearing the clergy, all the nonviolent people, right? Because they were on the same side as these people, at least to some, in that they opposed the fascists together, right? Again, they say that, you know, liberals always say that we have purity politics. I don't particularly, I'm not, like, I don't think a violent or, I don't even want to call it that. I don't think Antifa is particularly productive necessarily, but I will absolutely never pretend that there's any relationship between them and Nazis except for one of opposition.
Yeah, I have trouble imagining, this is why it was so jarring to log on and see people in DC and New York criticizing liberals, even liberals who associated with Antifa, which is like, I think like that's, I mean, while people were still under physical threat from Nazis, these pundits were criticizing this coalition that was keeping people safe.
Right.
I thought it was appalling, and I can't imagine if any of these, like, if you were on the ground and watching these fascists assault people, I don't know how you could see that and not be, if not grateful for Antifa, at least respect what they're doing. And with the clergy thing, like, and this is what I mean when I was saying everyone was working together and respecting diversity of tactics, where I think the Antifa people, because the clergy made this line in like a very, the kind of classic nonviolent action of like linking arms, and the Antifa, at least a few members went up to them and were like, how can we protect you in this? You know? So if you, and I don't know what it would have looked like without them. And if people think if they weren't there, then, I don't know, the Nazis would have kind of,
Or, the guy wouldn't have like, run into the crowd, right? I'm sure. Like,
it's like the Nazis were just minding their own business. You know, they didn't have any intentions to hurt anybody. And then the Antifa showed up.
It's
and
like in Back to the Future where the, like, people disappear from the photos.
Yes.
Like, if Antifa didn't show up, the Nazis would just kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Hitler wouldn't have been born.
You know, there's a... it makes me think of Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail where he talked about how he even said that...
To hear the full interview, the extended interview, make sure you go to our Patreon, patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.